Two, take one.
Parker.
Lights, camera, action!
Hollywood's business practices are weird. I'm not talking about the remakes or all the dead actors being resurrected or the movies based on your favorite brand. I'm talking about the soul-crushing stories that keep popping up in headlines, like the ongoing crisis for visual effects artists, or the horrible working conditions for animators, or the Writers and Actors Guild having to go on strike, or, I don't know, the fact that Warner Brothers keeps shelving movies for tax write-offs. Film studios are routinely criticized for their bizarre, shady tactics and for the ways that they screw over the people who actually make the movies that you see.
You will never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy.
But if you're looking for a portrait of Hollywood at its most deceitful, you need look no further than right here.
The Star Wars phenomenon is bigger than ever.
You can't escape from Star Wars mania.
The Return of the Jedi is now sweeping the continent.
The galactic faithful gathered in droves.
The lines were long, hours before the theater opened its doors.
When we got here, people just invaded. It was a madhouse.
Judging from the response across North America this week, Mr. Lucas has another big win.
May 1983, Return of the Jedi takes the box office by storm.
Record-breaking earnings on its very first day.
When the dust settles, it has a worldwide gross of almost $500 million off a budget in the low 30s. Massive profits all around. Except not for everybody. That was the story for David Prowse, the actor behind Darth Vader's mask. See, the contract he signed entitled him to a cut of the movie's profits. The problem is that, for years, Lucasfilm told him that the movie was still massively in the red. Quote, "I get these occasional letters from Lucasfilm saying that, we regret to inform you that as the movie has never gone into profit, we've got nothing to send you." Hold on. What?
What?
What? What?
I have a bad feeling about this.
This is a side of Hollywood that you don't see from your theater seat. That exchange between Lucasfilm and David Prowse, it happens all the time. This is something that spans the entire history of the film industry. It's inspired controversies. It's led to lawsuits. And it screwed over countless people in the process.
The movie companies have been screwing people for years.
This is the world of Hollywood accounting. But first, it's ad read time, because God knows we're not making any money from YouTube AdSense. Thank you, Google. Skip ahead to this timestamp if you hate me and don't want to support my work. This episode is sponsored by Aura, the only cool company on this cursed platform. Google your name real quick. Odds are some of your personal information comes up, right? If I search my name, it's just my public social media profiles. That's because Aura is my digital watchdog. If they get even a whiff of my data being sold, traded, or exposed in a breach anywhere on the internet, including the dark web, they track down the source and make sure they have a bad time. There are companies out there called data brokers whose whole purpose is to find and sell your data. They do it without your consent, and they make billions selling it to marketers, scammers, and even stalkers. They are the worst. Thanks to Aura, they're not my problem anymore. Aura forces them to remove my data, and they keep it removed. But that's just part of why I use and genuinely appreciate Aura. It's an all-in-one security tool. They provide real-time fraud alerts for credit and banking, 24/7 identity theft monitoring, a secure VPN, antivirus, parental controls, password manager, credit checker, and a lot more. And if somehow anything does happen, Aura includes $5 million in identity theft insurance, and they have US-based fraud experts on call 24/7. If you're anything like me, I'm sure you're sick and tired of these stupid, evil little companies stealing your personal information and using it to make a quick buck. That's why I use Aura. It keeps me and my family safe online. If you're ready to protect your data, you can get 2 weeks absolutely free when you use my link. During those 2 weeks, you'll see exactly where your data is being leaked and who's doing it. Give it a try. I promise you'll appreciate the peace of mind. And now, back to the show. Okay, so this is our starting point. You've got movies that, to all of us, look massively successful, but that studios claim are actually unprofitable. The Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Spider-Man, Alien, Bohemian Rhapsody is a good one. Take a look at this. Deadline calculated its profit at $350 million, but its studio, Fox, told its screenwriter, "Hey, sorry buddy, we lost $50 million on that one. We got nothing for you." That's a $400 million difference. How is that even possible? Well, it turns out, you don't have to look far for the answer. Roger Corman, the great B-movie director, once wrote, quote, "Without question, there is deviousness in the accounting." David O. Selznick, the famous producer who did Gone with the Wind, went one step further when he said that the entire industry is built on phony accounting. But to really get behind all the headlines and what the studios say, we need to go back to the 80s for a little while to talk about another blockbuster. Cue Mr. Eddie Murphy.
Good morning, my neighbors!
This is the 1988 film Coming to America, a comedy classic about an African prince searching for true love in the United States.
I want a woman that's going to arouse my intellect as well as my loins.
Where will you find such a woman?
In America.
A massive hit at the time. We've got Eddie Murphy, Arsenio Hall, James Earl Jones, we've got John Landis directing 2 years after the trial for
an accident that took place during the filming of Twilight Zone.
Never mind. But the person we're really interested in isn't on screen. He's not in the opening credits. He's not in the end credits. In fact, he's nowhere to be found. And that's this man, columnist Art Buchwald. If you want to understand the mechanics of just how studios screw people over, this is the key story. Buchwald v. Paramount Pictures. So in 1983, Buchwald sold a story treatment for a movie called King for a Day to Paramount, who wanted to develop the project into a feature for Eddie Murphy, their superstar box office draw in the 80s.
Officers, have we seen any, movie stars? Could y'all stop and point them out to me? I never seen no shit like that.
The project bounced around in development for a little while before being put into turnaround, meaning that Buchwald was free to shop the story around to other studios who might be interested, which he did. He sold it to Warner Brothers.
A brother is Warner.
Until he heard Paramount announce the beginning of production on their new Eddie Murphy comedy, Coming to America. Only problem, Coming to America had the same story as King for a Day. Buchwald complained, he was shrugged off, he hired a lawyer, filed a breach of contract suit against Paramount, and to make a long story short, he won. They successfully proved in court that Coming to America was based on Buchwald's story, and that Paramount was in breach of the original contract since the initial development period that began with King for a Day never actually concluded.
Where did the idea for Coming to America come from?
Where'd the idea for Coming to America come from?
And what this meant was that Buchwald was entitled to the terms of his original deal. $65,000 up front and 1.5% of the net profits for him, and $200,000 plus 40% of the net profits for his producing partner, Alan Bernheim.
The writer says he doesn't expect to see a lot of money out of this trial, but it's important anyway.
Well, after a while it becomes a... Sounds corny, but a matter of principle. We think we're fighting for a lot of writers in a lot of ways that the movie companies have been screwing people for years.
Now let's pause here. Let's stay on that term for a sec. Net profit. Maybe you've seen headlines about this kind of thing in Forbes or Business Insider. Profit participation deals like these are a staple in the industry. They've been around in Hollywood since the earliest days, but they really exploded in the 1950s when it became commonplace for big stars to receive profit points in addition to upfront salaries.
A tenth of a point after quadruple break even. You are really a shock, Al.
And the biggest of these deals? They'll make your head swim.
What a sale!
Warren Beatty famously got 40% of the gross profit on Bonnie and Clyde. Jack Nicholson reportedly earned upwards of $90 million for playing the Joker. Tom Cruise, $100 million for Top Gun Maverick. Christopher Nolan, $100 million for Oppenheimer. George Lucas and Steven Spielberg traded a couple of profit points on Star Wars and Close Encounters, netting both of them millions, Spielberg especially, on movies they had nothing to do with. Now, there are tons of different kinds of deals, and the bigger the star, the better the terms. The lower a person's profile, the less favorable terms they can demand. Generally speaking, though, profit-sharing deals in Hollywood can be divided into two categories. Those that are based on gross profit, and those that are based on net profit. On the face of it, this theoretically works exactly as you would expect it to. Gross profit is your full revenue before expenses have been deducted, and net is the amount of profit that's left over after all those deductions have been made. Gross is bigger, net is less. So people who get gross profit deals, we're talking big stars. Leonardo DiCaprio, Tom Hanks, Quentin Tarantino, Margot Robbie, people like that. However, more people in the industry are likely to get that net profit deal, which still sounds attractive though, right? The studio puts up the money, the movie does its business, expenses are recouped, and you get a percentage of the profits left over. Makes sense. Except, here's the thing. Net profit doesn't exist in Hollywood.
Say what?
I don't understand.
Explain yourself.
What's the big idea?
What do you mean?
There are no such thing as net profits. They give them to you because they're no such thing.
There's no net.
The net is fantasy.
That's how movie math works.
How could that even be fucking possible?
Yeah. It's simply a matter of creative accounting.
I don't know where the money is. It's just not there.
There are 330 feature films in that five-minute montage. And what's amazing is, according to Paramount, not one is yet to go into profit.
And if you can figure it out how they do that, you know, more power to you.
So, back to Coming to America. The judge in the case ruled that Art Buchwald was entitled to a share of the movie's net profits. You already know where this is going. Paramount submitted a net profit statement to Buchwald's lawyers in response. The movie grossed some $250 million off a budget of about $35 million, but, according to them, was still $18 million in the red. Now, okay, you've probably heard before that studios don't receive the total worldwide gross that a movie earns. It has to be split with movie theaters, usually somewhere between 40 to 50%. But even after that split, and after deducting the movie's production budget and marketing expenses, you've still got millions disappearing out of nowhere. How does this happen? Well, the answer is that studios play with a different set of rules. The giant gaps that you see, these happen because studios start piling on all these additional costs. Distribution fees, distribution expenses, trade dues, collection costs, anticipated expenses, studio overhead, advertising overhead, interest, interest on overhead, and on and on and on, 1,000 expenses, all of which can drive up a movie's total cost well past whatever the studio's total gross was. In fact, it's not uncommon for the combined total of these additional costs to match the costs actually associated with producing and marketing a movie. So, does that mean that all of these movies were never actually profitable? If that were true, how is any movie profitable? Well, this is where things start to look awfully fictional. For one, every movie is set up as its own individual corporation, and all of those extra fees are charged by and paid to the studio, even though the studio itself owns the corporation. So, in effect, the corporation will always look like it's in the red. But it's when all these additional charges and expenses come rolling in that the controversy really brews. To get a movie in the red, studios will stack charges and expenses that are supremely unfair, excessive, arbitrary, or sometimes just simply fake, like charging someone for services that didn't happen or aren't even real, like a studio charging expenses for shooting on a soundstage even though the movie was shot entirely on location in a forest somewhere. That happens. Or here's one. There's a story Variety reported on years ago where a studio added a $200,000 flat charge to every production for the videotapes they'd use for dailies, years after everyone had switched over to digital dailies delivered over the internet. That is the kind of nonsense we're dealing with.
Hooray for Hollywood.
It's just hilarious that they would come up to you and tell you that we did some deals with some other comics.
Dude, I get in business one time to make this TV show and the fucking guy's sends this the bill for the whole fucking thing. The guy was going to bill us $2,500 a month to use his copier machine, then another, I don't know, $4,500 to use his editing. It's like, dude, we have both of those things. We don't need those. Let's take that money and put it on the screen. How many fucking shows are you charging $2,500 a month to go, you know, fucking...
But even to buy a copy.
He probably has 9 shows paying $2,500 a month for him to go, that's it.
And it just gets more and more frustrating the more you look into it. It's all inflated costs here and there, or personal expenses charged to a movie.
This is so cool.
Or spreading the cost of flops to successful films. Or imposing insane markups for services. You know, hospitals charge like $500 for tissues. Same thing here.
Well, they've got a lot of expenses. You've got to understand these movie
companies.
It's a
non-profit organization, Charlie. It's a non-profit organization, and they don't lie because they're the company that made the Ten Commandments.
Who is on the Lord's side? Let him come to me.
Coming to America? Of course it made a profit. Actual, real profit, just like Star Wars, just like Lord of the Rings and Bohemian Rhapsody. But this method of inflating expenditures to such a degree that nothing ever shows up as profitable, it allows them to wipe away any obligation they might have of having to share some of those profits with someone like Art Buchwald or David Prowse or a thousand other people. That's Hollywood accounting. And it's why people say that net profit points are worthless.
You know, and to all the young filmmakers listening, I had 5% of the net of that movie, and it cost $19 million and it made $150 million worldwide. There's no net. That's how movie math works.
So even you were not above getting screwed by the
system.
Yeah,
so I told my attorney, I said, you know what? The next time you're negotiating my net profit for a movie, ask for a ham sandwich instead.
Because we'll get something.
Because I'll get something.
Oh, God, brother, you don't know.
They're a loser's gambit, or as one comedian dubbed them, monkey points. That's what Eddie Murphy himself called it during the deposition phase of the Buchwald trial.
He said in my deposition, I asked him about that. He started laughing. I don't take net profit. Those are monkey points. I said, well, excuse me, what do you mean by monkey? He said, well, when you get your statement, you laugh like a monkey because you're not going to get any money.
That's Pierce O'Donnell, Buchwald's lawyer representing him in the case.
And I learned a lot about Hollywood accounting. And so we attacked it.
After the trial wrapped, he wrote an account of the whole experience in a book called Fatal Subtraction. And all throughout the book, there's this lingering question that he has. It's the question that everybody asks. How is it that studios get away with this? To try to answer that question, you have to completely shift the way you think about some of these basic terms, like profit. See, O'Donnell and his team found that Paramount, just like every studio in Hollywood, kept two sets of books. One that followed GAAP and that they presented to their stockholders, the IRS, and the SEC, and another that was based on their definition of net profit. This is what they would present to people like Art Buchwald. That definition is a whole document in and of itself, this formula that studios have for what they're allowed to charge as an expense. Except, here's the thing. It's a definition that's purposely written in the most vague, opaque way so that studios are able to freely interpret it to encompass pretty much whatever they want it to. Take it from a group of CPAs and lawyers who work in the film industry. Quote, in standard profit participation agreements, the so-called Exhibit A definition to every talent contract, this is where the net profit formula is defined, is generally an obtuse, difficult document that even the studio's own negotiating attorney might not understand. Here's another, John Cohn's. Net profits can be granted or taken away at the complete discretion of the distributor because the film distribution agreements contain excessive amounts of ambiguous language or provisions providing enormous amounts of discretion to the distributor.
It was $19 million in the hole deficit. It didn't make sense to me until I reread the net profits rider to the contract. There's a separate document. I saw how they did their math, and I said, wow, that's like stealing at the point of a calculator.
This is how they get away with it. People hear the term Hollywood accounting, and they think it's all about cooking the books, but that's not really accurate. As O'Donnell found out, studios don't so much cook the books, they cook the contracts. They screw with them so they can wield their magic calculator that always adjusts in their favor. And if people have the balls to contest, and they fight it out later.
This just didn't make sense. We're sitting in my office in Century City one day, and I had my colleagues sitting around me, and I just said, this is just, I think I used a word before it, unconscionable. It's unconscionable.
So why would anybody sign a contract like this, you may ask? Well, it's not like most people in Hollywood have the kind of bargaining power to override or alter terms like these. Not everybody's Tom Cruise. We're talking about standard form, take it or leave it contracts here. You want to work in the film industry? Here you go. This is where you sign.
Would you like to use my pen?
Now, the typical studio defense to all this is usually some kind of, well, hey, running a major studio isn't exactly cheap. We have to claim all this so we can survive. All right, fair enough. Studios do have expenses. They have facilities and overhead, they have payroll, they contribute to pension plans. You gotta pay your secretaries, you know? But the problem is the extent to which that's taken. And there is no better example than Eddie Murphy. This is what O'Donnell's team discovered.
Ladies and gentlemen,
so Murphy's deal on Coming to America guaranteed him $8 million up front, plus 15% of the gross profit, remember that's revenue before any expenses have been deducted, which came out to more than $13 million. Now, this is important. Because of the way that the net profit formula is written, Paramount got to claim that $13 million gross participation as a production expense for everybody other than Eddie Murphy. For everyone else who worked on the movie, everyone lower down the totem pole, the budget of the movie wasn't the $35 million that it actually took to make the movie, it was almost $50 million, simply because of Murphy's cut of the profits. But it doesn't stop there. This is star treatment we're talking about. Quote, the comedian received a $5,000 a week living allowance, almost $5,000 for a limousine and round-the-clock chauffeur, and almost $4,000 per week for a motorhome. His entourage, his personal trainer, his assistants, his friends that hung around on set, all were taken care of, all paid for, all travel expenses covered, all given per diem. $5 million in total for living expenses and bullshit charges for his buddies all counted to the movie's budget. The press had a field day with this at the time, by the way. One item everyone loved, a $235 charge made on Eddie's petty cash account for breakfast at McDonald's for his friends.
And McDonald's, the meat is this thin. Your mother's shit is like this, is fatter. Looking at the grease in the pan, you're thinking to yourself, that don't look like no McDonald's.
But that is still not even the end of it. In 1987, Murphy renegotiated his contract with Paramount, who gave him a $6.8 million bonus, totally separate from the salary and profit points he'd received for the movies he'd star in for them. That bonus was then spread out over the budgets of his next four movies. So, Coming to America had an additional $1.7 million added to it that had absolutely nothing to do with the making of the movie. All of this constituted a massive part of Paramount's movie math to get Coming to America to look as though it was thoroughly entrenched in the red. But they had one final trick. And this is the trick that every studio has. The final nail in the coffin of net profit. So you might look at all this and say, okay, from Art Buchwald's perspective, yeah, this is pretty rough. The budget of the movie is very inflated, but hey, maybe the movie will continue to be really popular. Maybe with enough box office or re-releases or home video or enough TV deals, maybe the studio really will recoup their costs. They'll hit their break-even point and sail into net profitability. Right? No. See, over the course of a movie's life, there are always ongoing costs. Putting a movie back out in theaters? Well, that costs money. Putting out the VHS?
Now on video cassette.
That costs money. Putting out the DVD, and then the Blu-ray, and then the 4K, all bring in new costs. Flying the director out to do a Q&A somewhere, anything. This is the phenomenon known as rolling break-even. Because every time new expenses are incurred, they get charged to the movie, meaning that the total budget just keeps on getting bigger and bigger, and the break-even point gets pushed further and further away every time those inevitable new costs are tacked on. This is the clincher in all of this. You remember David Prowse saying that Return of the Jedi still wasn't profitable decades after it was released? This is why. When people say that net profit doesn't exist in Hollywood, this is the answer. When the dust settled, the judge in the Coming to America case found seven individual practices and provisions in Paramount's net profit formula to be unconscionable, including areas of significant double charging and numerous flat charges applied as percentages that bore no relation to actual costs. Paramount was ordered to pay Buchwald nearly $1 million, and for a minute there, it looked as though things were about to change. Journalists and industry insiders were saying the ruling would force studios to change their ways, that it would lead to more honest bookkeeping and encourage more equitable compensation. The entire industry could change. But Come on. I mean, of course that didn't happen. We're all still talking about this today. Art Buchwald even called it. After the trial, he was quoted saying, "We've changed what's going on in Hollywood, but not for long, because they'll find another way to screw them." While still significant, the Coming to America lawsuit didn't lead to the change that people expected it could and predicted it would. Yes, it's true that there are some companies that have made moves towards more generous profit sharing, like Pixar, or even Ben Affleck and Matt Damon's new company, Artists Equity. But on the whole, these practices have continued, and the number of lawsuits just like Art Buchwald's have only grown in the years since. Now, why does all of this matter? Why tell this story? Because, in the end, we're not really talking about stars. We're not talking about Tom Cruise or Christopher Nolan. We're not really even talking about someone like Eddie Murphy. We're talking about the people whose names you don't know. The people whose names aren't in lights. This is who a practice like Hollywood accounting affects. You remember the strikes 2 years ago? They were striking for reasons right next door to this. That's why this matters. This is who rotten business practices like these really affect.
The majority of our members are working people, just trying to put food on the table and pay their rent.
I want to end by bringing up something that I think is important. This is from Ed Solomon, the guy who wrote Men in Black and the Bill and Ted movies. He's since deleted his Twitter account, but he posted this back during the strikes, and I think it's pertinent. For those saying writers, most of whom hold second jobs, by the way, are rich, let me put it in a way that may make more sense to you. One script made into a film creates between 200 and 1,000 plus jobs. A successful film brings in hundreds of millions plus in revenue, $0 of which is shared with the writer. In my case, films I wrote have generated over $2 billion. Studio accounting has us believe that not one is in profit, even though they've spawned multiple sequels. Thus, I've gotten exactly $0 of my 5% of net points. Every film, as with every TV show, is an industry in and of itself. We are essentially building businesses in partnership with the financing entities. How is it fair that the creators and co-creators of these exceedingly lucrative businesses be forced to work as gig workers? But hey, this is all just showbiz, right? It's not evil. It's just Hollywood.
Hooray for Hollywood! And screwy, ballyhooey Hollywood! Where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking...